10-minute videotape of a conversation between a male professor and a female student. The student visits the professor's office to ask for a deadline extension for a term paper. The actors in the film are a female drama student and a male drama professor. Neither actor acts flirtatious or provocative, although both have been instructed to behave in a friendly manner. Participants witnessed the tape and then rated the likely intentions of the woman using 7-point scales. Women watching the interaction were more likely to say that the student was trying to be friendly, 6.45, not sexy, 2.0, or seductive, 1.89. Men, while also perceiving friendliness, 6.09, were more likely than women to infer seductive, 3.38, and sexual, 3.84 intentions. Similar results were obtained from a study using photos of a man and woman studying together. Men rated the photographed woman as showing moderate intent to be sexy, 4.87, and seductive, 4.08, whereas women rating the identical photographs saw considerably less sexual intent, 3.11, and less seductive intent, 2.61. Interestingly, men who view themselves as especially high in mate value are especially prone to experience the sexual overperception bias. Men who are dispositionally inclined to pursue a short-term mating strategy also exhibit a more pronounced sexual overperception bias, a bias that would facilitate the success of a short-term mating strategy by minimizing lost opportunities. A speed dating study conducted in my lab, led by Karen Perilou, found that men were especially susceptible to the sexual overperception bias when interacting with physically attractive women. An ironic finding, since attractive women are generally very choosy. The men were inferring interest in the minds of the women least likely to actually be interested. Nevertheless, as men act on their inferences, they do occasionally open up sexual opportunities. If over evolutionary history, even a tiny fraction of these sexual misperceptions led to sex, then men would have evolved lower thresholds for inferring women's sexual or romantic interest. Men's sexual overperception bias evolved to motivate approach. Once this male mechanism was in place, it became susceptible to manipulation. Women sometimes use their sexuality as a tactic in such manipulation. In one study of 200 university students, women significantly more than men reported smiling and flirting as a means of eliciting special treatment from members of the opposite sex, even though they had no interest in having sex with those men. Women, in short, sometimes exploit men's sexual overperception bias for their own ends. Men's perception of sexual interest in women combines with women's intentional exploitation of this psychological adaptation to create a potentially volatile mix. These sexual strategies lead to conflict over the desired level of sexual intimacy, over men's feeling that women lead them on, and over women's feeling that men are too pushy in the sexual sphere. Sexual pushiness sometimes slips over the line into sexual aggressiveness, the vigorous pursuit of sexual access despite a woman's reluctance or resistance. Sexual aggressiveness is one strategy men use to minimize the costs they incur for sexual access, although this strategy carries its own costs in the possibility of retaliation and damage to their reputation. Acts of sexual aggression include demanding or forcing sexual intimacy, failing to get mutual agreement for sex, and touching a woman's body without her permission. In one study, my lab asked women to evaluate 147 potentially upsetting actions that a man could perform. Women rated sexual aggression on average to be 6.5, or close to the 7.0 maximum of distress. No other kinds of acts that men could perform, including verbal abuse and non-sexual physical abuse, were judged by women to be as upsetting as sexual aggression. Contrary to a view held by some men, women do not want forced sex. Women sometimes have fantasies that involve forced sex with a man who turns out to be rich and handsome, and sometimes the theme of forced sex occurs in romance novels. But neither of these circumstances means that women actually desire forced or non-consensual sex. Men, in sharp contrast, seem considerably less bothered if a woman is sexually aggressive. They see it as relatively innocuous compared with other sources of discomfort. On the same 7-point scale, for example, men judged the group of sexually aggressive acts to be only 3.02, or only lightly upsetting when performed by a woman. A few men spontaneously commented that they would find such acts sexually arousing if a woman performed them. Other sources of distress, such as a mate's infidelity and verbal or physical abuse, were seen by men as far more upsetting, 6.04 and 5.55 respectively, than sexual aggression by a woman. A disturbing difference between the genders is that men consistently underestimate how unacceptable sexual aggression is to women. When asked to judge its negative impact on women, men rated it only 5.8 on the 7-point scale, which is significantly lower than the women's own rating of 6.5. The implication of this alarming source of conflict between the sexes is that some men may be inclined to use aggressive sexual acts because they fail to comprehend how distressing these acts really are to women. In addition to creating conflict, men's failure to correctly understand the psychological pain that women experience from sexual aggression may be one cause of men's lack of empathy for rape victims. The callous remark by a Texas politician that if a woman cannot escape a rape, she should just lie back and enjoy it, could only have been uttered by someone who fails to understand the magnitude of the trauma experienced by women who are victims of sexual aggression. Women, in contrast, overestimated how upsetting sexual aggression by a woman is to a man, judging it to be 5.13 or moderately upsetting, in contrast to men's rating of only 3.02. Men and women both err in cross-sex mind reading. These cognitive biases may result from false beliefs about the other gender, mistakenly extrapolating from their own projected reactions. Men seem to think that women are more like them than they really are, and women seem to think that men are more like them than they really are. Acquiring knowledge about gender differences in perceptions of sexual aggression might be one step toward reducing sexual conflict. The flip side of the coin of sexual aggression is sexual withholding. Men consistently complain about women's sexual withholding, defined by such acts as sexual teasing, saying no to having sex, and leading a man on and then turning him away. On the same 7-point scale of magnitude of upset, men judged sexual withholding to be 5.03, whereas women judged it to be 4.29. Both genders are bothered by sexual withholding, but men significantly more so than women. For women, sexual withholding fulfills several possible functions. One is to preserve their ability to choose men of high mate value, those who are willing to commit emotionally, to invest materially, or to contribute high-quality genes, or ideally all three. Women withhold sex from certain men and selectively allocate it to others of their own choosing. Moreover, by withholding sex, women increase its value and render it a scarce resource. Scarcity ratchets up the price that men are willing to pay for it. If the only way men can gain sexual access is by heavy investment, then they will make that investment. Under conditions of sexual scarcity, men who fail to invest fail to mate. This creates another conflict between a man and a woman, since her withholding interferes with his strategy of gaining sex sooner and with fewer emotional strings attached. Another function of sexual withholding is to manipulate a man's perception of a woman's value as a mate. Because highly desirable women are less sexually accessible to the average man by definition, a woman may influence a man's perception of her desirability by withholding sexual access. Highly desirable women are, in fact, hard to get. So, men interpret the difficulty of gaining sexual access to a woman as a cue to her mate value. Finally, sexual withholding, at least initially, may encourage a man to evaluate a woman as a long-term mate rather than a sexual fling. Granting sexual access early often causes a man to see a woman as a casual mate. By withholding sex, women create challenges for men. They circumvent the component of men's mating strategy that involves seeking low-cost sex. Certainly, women have a right to choose when, where, and with whom they want to have sex. But the exercise of that choice interferes with one of men's deep-seated sexual strategies, and is therefore experienced by men as bothersome or upsetting. Hence, it is one of the key sources of conflict between the sexes. Emotional commitment. In the most abstract sense, people solve adaptive problems by one of two means: by their own labor or by securing the labor of others. In principle, people who can successfully obtain the effort of others with a minimal investment can be more successful in solving life's adaptive problems. It is often in a woman's best interest, for example, to have a man so devoted to her that all of his energies are channeled to her and her children. It is often in a man's best interest, however, to allocate only a portion of his resources to one woman, reserving the rest for additional adaptive problems, such as seeking additional mating opportunities or achieving higher social status. Hence, individual women and men are often at odds over each other's commitments. A key sign of conflict over commitment centers on the irritation women express about men's tendency not to express their feelings openly. One of the most frequent complaints women have about men is that they are emotionally constricted. Among newlyweds, for example, 45% of women, in contrast to only 24% of men, complain that their mates fail to express their true feelings. During the dating phase, roughly 25% of women complain that their partners ignore their feelings. This increases to 30% in the first year of marriage. By the fourth year of marriage, 59% of women complain that their husbands ignore their feelings. In contrast, only 12% of newlywed men and 32% of men in their fourth year of marriage make this complaint. From a woman's vantage point, what are the benefits she gains by getting a man to express his emotions, and what are the costs she incurs if he fails to express them? From a man's vantage point, are there benefits to withholding the expression of emotions and costs to expressing them? One source of this gender difference stems from the fact that men's reproductive resources are more easily divided than women's. Within any one-year period, for example, a woman can only get pregnant by one man, and so the bulk of her reproductive resources cannot be easily partitioned. Within that same year, a man can divide his resources by investing in two or more women. One reason men fail to express their emotions is that investing less emotionally in a relationship frees up resources that can be channeled toward other women or other goals. As in many negotiable exchanges, it is often in a man's best interest not to reveal how strong his desires are or how intensely he is willing to commit. Turkish rug dealers wear dark glasses to conceal their interest. Gamblers strive for a poker face to disguise telltale emotions that give away their hands. Emotions often betray the degree of investment. If emotions are concealed, one's sexual strategies remain concealed as well. The lack of information causes women to agonize, to sift through the available signs trying to discern where men really stand. College women, far more than college men, report spending time recalling and dissecting with friends conversations and activities they experienced with the people they are dating. They try to analyze their partner's real inner states, intentions, emotions, and motivations. Conflict over commitment resides at the core of complaints about men's emotional constrictedness. Concealment of sexual strategies is not the only force driving men to remain stoic, nor are men necessarily inept at expressing emotions under different circumstances. Similarly, women sometimes conceal their emotions for strategic reasons. In the mating arena, however, discerning the long-term intentions of a partner is less critical for men than for women. Women in ancestral times who erred in their assessment suffered severe costs by granting sexual access to men who failed to commit to them. Getting a man to express himself emotionally represents one tactic that women use to gain access to the important information they need to discern a man's degree of commitment. Perhaps that's why singer Madonna exhorts women to put love to the test by getting men to express themselves. Only then will they know if his love is real. While women complain that men are emotionally constricted, men commonly complain that women are too moody and emotional. Roughly 30% of dating men, in contrast to 19% of dating women, complain about their partner's moodiness. These figures increase to 34% of men during the first year of marriage and jump to 49% of men by the fourth year of marriage, in contrast with married women of whom only 25% make these complaints. Moody partners absorb time and psychological energy. Appeasing responses, such as efforts to get the partner out of the bad mood and putting one's own plans aside temporarily, take up energy at the expense of other goals. Women impose these costs on men as a tactic for eliciting commitment. A moody woman may be saying, "You had better increase your commitment to me, or else I will burden you with my emotional volatility." It is one tactic in women's repertoire for eliciting male commitment. Men dislike it because it requires that they expend effort that could be allocated to solving other adaptive challenges. Moodiness also functions as an assessment device to test the strength of the bond. Women use moodiness to impose small costs on their mates and then use men's reactions to the costs as a gauge of their degree of commitment. If a man is unwilling to tolerate these costs, it is a cue that his commitment is low. Men's willingness to tolerate the costs and to be responsive to the increasing demands for investment signals a greater level of commitment. Either way, the woman gains valuable information about the strength of the bond. Neither the functions of moodiness nor the functions of emotional reserve require conscious thought to be strategically enacted. Women need not be aware that they are attempting to test the strength of the man's commitment. Men need not be aware that they are trying to minimize their commitment to preserve some for efforts outside the couple. The functions of adaptations for dealing with sexual conflict over emotional expression remain largely hidden from view. Resource investment. In addition to emotional commitment, couples also skirmish over the investment of time, energy, and resources. Neglect and unreliability are manifestations of commitment conflicts. More than one-third of all dating and married women complain that their partners neglect them, reject them, and subject them to unreliable treatment. Among their common complaints are that men do not spend enough time with them, fail to call when they say they will, show up late, and cancel arrangements at the last minute. Roughly twice as many women as men complain about these events. Approximately 38% of dating women, for example, but only 12% of dating men, complain that their partners sometimes fail to call them when they say they will. Upset over neglect and unreliability reflects a conflict over investment of time and effort. It takes effort to be on time. Reliability requires relinquishing time and resources that could be channeled toward other goals. Neglect signals a low investment, indicating that the man lacks the depth of commitment necessary to perform acts that require even minimal cost for the woman's benefit. Marriage does not extinguish conflict over investments. Indeed, as the marriage progresses from the newlywed year to the fourth year, women's complaints about neglect and unreliability increase. Roughly 41% of newlywed women and 45% of women married for 4 years express irritation that their partners do not spend enough time with them. The analogous figures for men are only 4% during the newlywed year and 12% during the fourth year of marriage. The flip side of the coin of neglect is dependency and possessiveness. Conflict develops when one mate absorbs so much energy that the partner's freedom is restricted. A common grievance of married men, far more than of married women, is that their spouse takes up too much of their time and energy. 36% of married men, in contrast with only 7% of married women, express irritation that their spouse demands too much of their time. 29% of married men, but only 8% of married women, complain that their mates demand too much attention. These gender differences in demands on time and attention reflect a continuing conflict about investment. Women try to sequester their mate's investment. Some men resist monopolization, striving to channel a portion of their effort toward other adaptive problems, such as raising their status or acquiring additional mates. More than three times as many men as women voice possessiveness complaints. For men, historically, there was a large and direct reproductive payoff to preserving some investment for acquiring status and additional mates. For women, the benefits were smaller, less direct, and often more costly because they risked the loss of the existing mate's investment of time and resources. Wives may be possessive and demanding because they do not want their husband's limited investment to be diverted away from them. Another manifestation of investment conflict centers on grievances about a partner's selfishness. Among married couples, 38% of men and 39% of women complain that their partner acts selfishly. Similarly, 37% of married women and 31% of married men lament their partner's self-centeredness. The core of selfishness centers on allocating resources to oneself at the expense of others, such as a spouse or children. Complaints about self-centeredness rise dramatically during the course of marriage. During the first year of marriage, only 13% of women and 15% of men complain that their partner is self-centered. By the fourth year of marriage, the numbers more than double. To understand these dramatic changes, consider the critical signals of investment during the courting stage. Effective courting communicates a willingness to put a mate's interests before your own, or at least on par with your own. These cues are powerful tactics for attracting a mate and are displayed most floridly while courting. After the mateship is reasonably secure, the tactics signaling selflessness subside, because their initial function of attracting a mate recedes. Each gender becomes freer to indulge the self and to channel less effort toward the partner. This is what long-term couples mean when they grumble that their partner takes them for granted. The picture is not a very pretty one, but humans were not designed by natural selection to coexist in mating bliss. They were designed for individual survival and genetic reproduction. The psychological mechanisms fashioned by these ruthless evolutionary criteria are sometimes selfish. Conflicts over investment often center on money. A study of American couples found that money is one of the most frequent sources of conflict. 72% of married couples fight about money at least once a year, with 15% fighting more than once a month. Interestingly, couples fight more about how the money they have is to be allocated than about how much money they have in their joint pool of resources. American men, far more often than women, complain that their spouse spends too much money on clothes. The percentage of men who express this grievance starts at 12% during the newlywed year and increases to 26% by the fourth year of marriage. In contrast, among women, only 5% during the newlywed year and 7% during the fifth year of marriage are bothered by their husband's spending on clothes. Both, however, complain equally that their spouse spends too much money in general. Nearly one-third of men and women by the fourth year of marriage complain about their spouse's overexpenditure of mutual resources. More women than men complain that their spouse fails to channel the money they do earn to them, especially noting their failure to buy them gifts. By the fifth year of marriage, roughly one-third of married women voice this complaint. In contrast, only 10% of husbands express similar complaints. Conflict between the sexes corresponds remarkably well with the initial gender-linked preferences in a mate. Women select mates in part for their economic resources and, once married, complain more than men that those resources are not forthcoming or abundant enough. Deception. Conflicts between the sexes over sexual access, emotional commitment, and investment of resources reach more dramatic proportions when we add deception to the mix. Deception flourishes in the plant and animal world. Some orchids, for example, have brilliantly colored petals and centers that mimic the colors, shapes, and scents of female wasps of the species Scolia ciliata. Male wasps, powerfully attracted by these scents and colors, land on the orchids the way they would land on a female's back. This event is followed by a pseudocopulation, in which the male moves rapidly over the rigid hairs of the upper surface of the flower, which mimic the hairs on a female wasp's abdomen. He probes the orchid in an apparent search for complementary female genital structures, incidentally picking up the plant's pollen. Failing to find the exact structures needed for ejaculation, however, the male moves on to another pseudo-female. Orchids deceive the male wasp for the function of cross-pollination. Humans also engage in sexual deception. A colleague used to go to upscale hotel bars and pick up men who would take her out to dinner. During dinner, she was friendly, flirtatious, sexy, and engaging. Toward the end of dinner, she would excuse herself to go to the woman's room, then slip out the back door and disappear into the night. Sometimes she did this alone, sometimes with a girlfriend. Her targets were often businessmen from out of town, whom she would be unlikely to encounter again. Although she spoke no lies, she was a sexual deceiver. She used sexual clues to elicit resources, and then left sneakily without following through with sex. One can't feel too sorry for the guys, though, since many were married and pursuing their own forms of deception. Although this tactic may be unusual, its underlying theme occurs repeatedly in ordinary behavior in various guises. Women are apparently aware of the sexual effects they have on men. When 104 college women were asked how often they flirted with a man to get something they wanted, such as a favor or special treatment, knowing that they did not want to have sex with him, they gave this action on average a frequency of 3 on a 4-point scale, where 3 signified sometimes and 4 signaled often. The comparable figure for men was 2. Women gave similar responses to questions about using sexual hints to gain favors and attention, yet admitted that they had no intention of having sex with the targets of these hints. Some women acknowledge being sexual deceivers as one tactic in their strategic arsenal. Although women are more likely to be sexual deceivers, men are more likely to be commitment deceivers. Consider what a 33-year-old man had to say about the commitment implied by declarations of love. You would think saying "I love you" to a woman to thrill and entice her isn't necessary anymore. But that's not true. These three words have a tonic-like effect. I blurt out a declaration of love whenever I'm in the heat of passion. I'm not always believed, but it adds to the occasion for both of us. It's not exactly a deception on my part. I have to feel something for her. And what the hell? It usually seems like the right thing to say at the time. When my lab asked 112 college men whether they had ever exaggerated the depth of their feelings for a woman in order to have sex with her, 71% admitted to having done so, compared with only 39% of the women who were asked a parallel question. When the women were asked whether a man had ever deceived them by his exaggeration of the depth of his feelings in order to have sex with her, 97% admitted that they had experienced this tactic at the hands of men. In contrast, only 59% of the men had experienced this tactic at the hands of women. Among married couples, deception continues in the form of sexual infidelity. The motivations for male infidelity are clear, since ancestral men who had extramarital affairs might sire additional children and thereby gain a reproductive advantage over their more loyal rivals. Women get extremely upset by male infidelity because it signals that the man is diverting resources to other women and might even defect from their relationship. Women stand to lose the entire investment secured through the marriage, and replacing a husband is not always easy, especially if a woman has children. Consequently, evolutionists have predicted that women will be far more upset by an affair that contains emotional involvement than about one that does not, because emotional involvement typically signals outright defection rather than the less costly siphoning off of a fraction of resources. Women turn out to be more forgiving and less upset if no emotional involvement accompanies their husband's fling. Men seem to know this. When caught having an affair, men often plead that the other woman means nothing. In the human mating dance, the costs of being deceived about a potential mate's resources and commitment are carried more heavily by women. An ancestral man who made a poor choice in sex partners risked losing only a small portion of time, energy, and resources, although he may have evoked the rage of a jealous boyfriend or protective father. An ancestral woman who made a poor choice of a casual mate, allowing herself to be deceived about the man's long-term intentions, risked enduring pregnancy, childbirth, and child care unaided, and being less able to attract an alternative mate, since existing children are seen as costs by potential mates on the mating market. Because the deceived can suffer large losses, selection favored the evolution of psychological vigilance to detect cues to deception and to prevent its occurrence. Humans today are experiencing one more cycle in the endless spiral of an evolutionary arms race between deception by one gender and detection by the other. As the deceptive tactics get more subtle, the ability to detect deception becomes more sensitive. Women guard against deception. When they are seeking a committed relationship, an important first-line defense is imposing courtship costs by requiring extended time, energy, and costly signals before consenting to sex. More time buys more assessment. It allows a woman greater opportunity to evaluate a man, to assess how committed he is to her, and to detect whether he is burdened by prior commitments to other women and children. Men who seek to deceive women about their ultimate intentions typically tire of extended courtship. They go elsewhere for sex partners who are more readily available. Although women have developed strategies for penetrating men's deception, men clearly cannot ignore deception at the hands of women. This is especially true when men seek spouses. Accurate assessments of women's reproductive value, resources, alliances, and fidelity become paramount. This is vividly illustrated in a scene from Tennessee Williams's play, A Streetcar Named Desire. Mitch is on a date with Blanche DuBois, a former high school teacher to whom he is engaged to be married, but who has deceived him about her sexual past with other men, including a sexual relationship with a student that caused her expulsion from the school. A friend has just alerted Mitch to Blanche's past, so he aggressively tells her that he has always seen her only at night under a dim light, never in a well-lit room. He turns on a bright light, from which Blanche recoils, but he sees that she is older than she had led him to believe. He confronts her with what he has heard about her flamboyant sexual past. She plaintively asks Mitch whether he will still marry her. He says, "No, I don't think I'll marry you now," as he nevertheless approaches her menacingly for sex. Given the importance that men attach to looks and sexual exclusivity in a potential mate, they are especially sensitive to deception about a woman's age and sexual history. Men are keenly attuned to information about women's sexual reputations. Vigilance guards them against deception about two of the most reproductively important considerations for a man seeking a long-term mate: her reproductive value, and the likelihood that her value will be channeled exclusively to him. Unfortunately, conflict between the sexes does not end with battles about sexual access, commitment, or deception. Sometimes, it takes more violent forms. Intimate partner violence. Violence takes several forms. One is psychological abuse, which causes a wife to feel less valuable in the relationship, to lower her sense of desirability, and make her feel lucky to have secured the husband, and to diminish her perceived prospects on the mating market if she is contemplating abandoning the mateship. Two functional tactics of psychological abuse are condescension and contempt. Condescension manifests through two methods. In one, a man places more value on his opinions simply because he is a man. In another, a man treats his mate as if she were stupid or inferior. Newlywed men condescend roughly twice as often as their wives do. These acts have the effect of lowering the wife's sense of her own desirability. Condescension, one form of which is mansplaining, may function to increase the victim's investment and commitment to the relationship, and to bend the victim's energies toward the goals of the abuser. Victims often feel that because their mating alternatives are not rosy, they must strive valiantly to placate the current mate. They also appease the partner to avoid incurring his further wrath. Psychological abuse sometimes escalates from verbal abuse to physical violence. Men's motives for battering women center heavily on coercive control. One researcher attended the trials of 100 Canadian couples engaged in litigation over the husband's violence toward the wife. The researcher concluded that at the core of nearly all the cases was the husband's frustration about his inability to control his wife, whom he frequently accused of being a whore or of having sex with other men. A study of 31 battered American women found that jealousy was the main topic of spousal arguments. Jealousy led to physical abuse in 52% of the cases, with 94% listing jealousy as a frequent cause of the history of battering in the relationship. In yet another study, for 95% of 60 battered wives who had sought the assistance of a clinic in North Carolina, morbid jealousy, such as jealousy if the wife left the house for any reason, or if she maintained friendships with other men or women, had evoked violent reactions from their husbands. The coercive constraint of women, particularly in sexual matters, underlies most cases of physical abuse. Spouse abuse is obviously a dangerous game to play. The abuser may be seeking increased commitment and investment, but the tactic may backfire and produce a desire to leave instead. Alternatively, this form of abuse may represent a last-ditch attempt to hold on to a mate who is on the brink of leaving. In this sense, the abuser treads on thin ice. He risks triggering the decision that the relationship is too costly to endure. Perhaps this is why abusers are often profusely apologetic after the abuse, crying, pleading, and promising that they will never do it again. Partner abuse is not a Western invention. It occurs cross-culturally. Among the Yanomamo, for example, husbands regularly strike their wives with sticks for offenses as slight as serving tea too slowly. Interestingly, Yanomamo wives often regard physical abuse as a sign of the depth of their husband's love for them, an interpretation probably not shared by their modern American counterparts. Whatever the interpretation, these beatings have the effect of subordinating Yanomamo women to their husbands. Men sometimes abuse their partner by insulting her physical appearance. Although only 5% of newlywed men do so, the percentage triples by the fourth year of marriage. In marked contrast, only 1% of newlywed women insult their husband's appearance, and only 5% of longer married women do so. Given that a woman's physical appearance is typically a key component of her mate value, women find these derogations especially distressing. Men may insult their appearance to lower women's perception of their own desirability, thereby securing a more favorable power balance within the relationship. As with other destructive tendencies, the fact that abuse has an adaptive logic behind it does not mean that people should accept it, desire it, or be lax about curtailing it. On the contrary, greater understanding of the logic behind abusive tactics and the contexts in which they occur should lead to more effective means of curtailing them. Men who have certain personality dispositions, such as being emotionally unstable, are 4 times as likely to abuse their wives as emotionally stable men. Discrepancies in the desirability of the two partners, a long distance between the couple's residence and that of the woman's kin, and the absence of legal penalties for abuse are contexts that put women at increased risk. Sexual harassment. Although abuse and other forms of conflict are common within couples, sexual conflict is also common outside of mating relationships. For instance, disagreements over sexual access sometimes occur in the workplace, where people often seek casual and romantic mates. The search may cross a line and become sexual harassment, which can be defined as unwanted and unsolicited sexual attention from other individuals in the workplace. It includes mild forms, such as unwanted staring at a woman's breasts and body, what one woman described as the up-down as a man scans her physique from head to toe. It includes sexual comments, such as nice ass or beautiful body, and it includes physical violations, such as the touching of breasts, buttocks, or thighs. Sexual harassment clearly produces conflict between the sexes. Evolutionary psychology offers insight into the psychology that motivates sexual harassment and the circumstances that trigger it. Sexual harassment is typically motivated by the desire for short-term sexual access, although it is sometimes motivated by power or by a search for a lasting romantic relationship. Evolved sexual strategies shed light on sexual harassment through the profiles of typical victims, including such features as their age, marital status, and physical attractiveness, their reactions to unwanted sexual advances, and the conditions under which they were harassed. Victims of sexual harassment are not random. In one study of complaints filed with the Illinois Department of Human Rights over a 2-year period, 76 complaints were filed by women and only 5 by men. Another study of 10,644 federal government employees found that 42% of the women, but only 15% of the men, had experienced sexual harassment at some point in their career. Among complaints filed in Canada under human rights legislation, 93 cases were filed by women and only 2 by men. In both cases filed by men, the harassers were men rather than women. Women are generally the victims and men the perpetrators. Nonetheless, because women experience greater distress than do men in response to acts of sexual aggressiveness, women might be more likely to file official complaints than men when harassed. The victims of sexual harassment are disproportionately young, physically attractive, single women. Women over 45 are less likely to be victims. One study found that women between the ages of 20 and 35 filed 72% of the complaints of harassment, whereas they represented only 43% of the workforce at the time. Women over 45, who represented 28% of the workforce, filed only 5% of the complaints. The victims of sexual harassment are women whose relative youth evokes male sexual interest in general. Single and divorced women are subjected to more sexual harassment than married women. In one study, single women represented only 25% of the workforce, but filed 43% of complaints. Married women, comprising 55% of the workforce, filed only 31% of the complaints. There may be several reasons for these differences. Husbands sometimes function as bodyguards, deterring would-be harassers. Moreover, men perceive single women to be more receptive to sexual advances or more easily sexually exploitable. Reactions to sexual harassment also follow evolutionary psychological logic. When men and women were asked how they would feel if a coworker of the opposite sex asked them to have sex, 63% of the women said they would be insulted, while only 17% said that they would feel flattered. Men's reactions were just the opposite. Only 15% would be insulted and 67% would feel flattered. These reactions fit with the evolutionary psychology of human mating. Men generally have more positive emotional reactions to the prospect of casual sex. Women react more negatively to being treated as mere sex objects. The degree of anguish women experience from unwanted sexual advances, however, depends in part on the status of the harasser. My lab asked 109 college women how upset they would feel if a man they did not know, whose occupational status varied from low to high, persisted in asking them out on a date despite repeated refusals, a relatively modest form of harassment. On a 7-point scale, women said that they would be most upset by advances from construction workers, 4.04, garbage collectors, 4.32, cleaning men, 4.19, and gas station attendants, 4.13, and least upset by persistent advances from pre-medical students, 2.63, graduate students, 2.80, and successful rock stars, 2.71. Women's distress in response to the same acts of harassment varies depending on men's status. Women's reactions to sexual harassment also depend heavily on whether the motivation of the harasser is perceived to be sexual or romantic. Sexual bribery, attaching job promotions to sex, and other cues that the person is interested only in casual sex are more likely to be labeled as harassment than are signals of potential interest that may transcend the purely sexual, such as non-sexual touching, complimentary looks, or flirting. When 110 college women used a 7-point scale to rate how sexually harassing a series of acts by their coworkers would be, acts such as putting his hand on a woman's genital area, 6.81, or trying to corner a woman when no one else was around, 6.03, were seen as extremely harassing. In contrast, acts such as telling a woman that he sincerely liked her and would like to have coffee with her after work was judged to be only 1.5, 1.0 signifying no harassment at all. Clearly, short-term sexual and coercive intentions are more harassing than sincere romantic intentions. These findings about the profiles of sexual harassment victims, the sex differences in emotional reactions, and the importance of the status of the harasser all follow from the evolutionary psychology of human mating strategies. Men have evolved lower thresholds for seeking casual sex, and their sexual overperception bias leads them to infer sexual interest where none exists. These sexual adaptations become activated in the workplace perhaps no less than in any other social context. Sexual assault. Rape may be defined as the use of force or the threat to use force to obtain sex. Estimates of the number of women who have been raped vary, depending on how inclusive a definition the researcher uses. Some researchers use broad definitions that include instances in which a woman did not perceive that she was raped at the time, but admitted later that she did not really want to have intercourse or regretted doing so. Other researchers use stricter definitions that delimit rape to clear cases of forced intercourse against the woman's will. One large-scale study of 2016 university women, for example, found that 6% had been raped. Another study found, however, that almost 15% of 380 college women had been involved in sexual intercourse against their will. Given the large social stigma attached to victims and the well-known underreporting of rape, these figures probably underestimate the actual numbers of women who have been raped. The issue of rape has a bearing on human mating strategies, in part because many rapes occur within the context of mating relationships. Dating is a common context for rape. One study found that almost 15% of college women had experienced unwanted sexual intercourse in a dating encounter. Another study found that for 63% of 347 women, all instances of sexual victimization were perpetrated by dates, lovers, husbands, or de facto partners. The most extensive study of rape in marriage found that of nearly 1,000 married women, 14% had been raped by their husband. Rape in the modern world often does not fit the stereotype of a menacing stranger jumping out of a dark alley. Men are almost invariably the perpetrators of rape, and most victims are women, although victims also include children and men. It is a matter of controversy within the scientific community whether rape represents an evolved sexual strategy of men or is better understood as a horrifying side effect of men's general sexual strategy of seeking low-cost casual sex. Among scorpion flies, however, the evidence for rape as an evolved strategy is strong. The males have a special anatomical clamp that functions solely in the context of raping a female and not in consensual mating, for which a male offers a nuptial gift. Experiments that seal the clamp with wax prevent the male from achieving a forced copulation. Scorpion flies have rape adaptations, but what about humans? Have men evolved adaptations to rape? Controversy about the possibility that men have evolved adaptations to rape erupted in the year 2000, when the biologist Randy Thornhill and the anthropologist Craig Palmer published a book called A Natural History of Rape, biological bases of sexual coercion. Although evolutionary theories of human rape had been published for 2 decades preceding its publication, their book proved to be a flashpoint. The authors outlined 2 competing theories of rape, one endorsed by each author. Thornhill proposes the theory that men have evolved rape adaptations, specialized psychological mechanisms for forcing sex on unwilling women as a reproductive strategy. Palmer proposes instead that rape is a byproduct of other evolved mechanisms, such as the male desire for sexual variety, a desire for low-cost consensual sex, a psychological sensitivity to sexual opportunities, and the general capacity of men to use physical aggression to achieve a wide variety of goals. The rape as adaptation theory proposes 6 specialized adaptations that may have evolved in the male mind. Assessment of the vulnerability of potential rape victims. For example, in the context of warfare, or a non-warfare situation in which a woman lacks the protection of a husband or kin. A context-sensitive switch that motivates rape by men who lack sexual access to consenting partners, such as low-status males who cannot obtain mates through regular channels of courtship. A preference for maximally fertile rape victims. An increase in sperm counts of rape ejaculates compared with those occurring in consensual sex. Male sexual arousal specifically to the use of force or to signs of female resistance to consensual sex. And context-specific marital rape when sperm competition might exist, such as when there is evidence or suspicion of female infidelity. Evidence supporting these hypothesized adaptations is either absent or ambiguous. Rape is common in war, clearly a context where women are often vulnerable, but so is theft, looting, and property damage. Are there specialized adaptations for all these behaviors, or are they instead either byproducts of other psychological mechanisms, or merely the output of more general cost-benefit evaluation mechanisms? Decisive studies have not yet been conducted. Although there is no conclusive evidence supporting the rape as adaptation theory, psychological and physiological experiments have revealed some disturbing findings. Laboratory studies that expose men to audio and visual depictions of rape versus mutually consenting sexual encounters find that men display sexual arousal, assessed both by self-report and by penile tumescence, to both consenting and non-consenting situations. Men apparently are sexually aroused when exposed to sexual scenes, whether or not consent is involved. Nonetheless, other conditions, such as the presence of violence, evidence that the victim experiences pain, and a disgust reaction from the victim, inhibit the sexual arousal of most men. These findings cannot differentiate between the 2 explanatory alternatives, that men have only a general tendency to be sexually aroused in response to witnessing sexual encounters, and hence have no distinct adaptations to forced sex, or that men have evolved a distinct rape psychology. Consider a food analogy. Humans, like dogs, salivate when they smell appetizing food, especially if they have not eaten for a while. Suppose that a scientist hypothesizes that humans have a specific adaptation to take food forcibly from others. The scientist then conducts studies in which people are deprived of food for 24 hours and thereafter exposed visually to 1 of 2 scenes. Appetizing food that is given willingly by one person to another person, or equally appetizing food that is forcibly taken from one person by another. If this hypothetical experiment finds that people salivate an equal volume to both food scenes, we cannot conclude that people have a distinct food adaptation to take food forcibly. All we can conclude is that when hungry, people seem to salivate when exposed to scenes of food, regardless of the circumstances surrounding the method of procurement. This hypothetical example is analogous to the findings that indicate sexual arousal in men in response to sexual scenes, regardless of whether those scenes depict mutually consenting sex or forced sex. The data do not constitute evidence that rape is a distinct evolved strategy of men. Another possible piece of evidence for rape adaptation theory is that convicted rapists come disproportionately from lower socioeconomic groups, supporting the mate deprivation hypothesis. Some interviews with rapists support this view. One serial rapist, for example, reported that, "I felt that my social station would make her reject me, and I didn't feel that I would be able to make this person. I didn't know how to go about meeting her. I took advantage of her fright and raped her." For men who lack the status, money, or other resources to attract women, coercion may represent a desperate alternative. Men scorned by women because they lack the qualities for attracting desirable mates may develop hostility toward women, an attitude that short-circuits the normal empathic response and so promotes coercive sexual behavior. But this finding could also be caused by lower rates of reporting when rape is committed by men from higher social groups, or from the greater ability of privileged men to evade arrest and conviction because they can afford to hire expensive lawyers. Or perhaps women raped by high-status men are less likely to press charges, given the lower odds of being believed and obtaining justice. There is also direct evidence against the mate deprivation hypothesis of rape. In a study of 156 heterosexual men, average age of 20, the evolutionary psychologist Martin Lalumière and his colleagues measured the use of sexual coercion with items such as, "Have you ever had sexual intercourse with a woman even though she didn't really want to because you used some degree of physical force?" Separately, they measured mating success. Men who scored high on mating success also scored high on sexual aggression. Men who had had a lot of sexual partners were more likely to report using force. Furthermore, men who evaluated their future earning potential as high reported using more, not less, physical coercion in their mating tactics. Although additional studies are needed, we can tentatively conclude that a simple version of the mate deprivation theory of rape is unlikely to be correct. These results, however, do not rule out a more complex hypothesis. Perhaps men have evolved two kinds of context-specific rape adaptations, one contingent on when they experience mating failure and one when the costs are so low that they can get away with it, as might occur among the upper socioeconomic stratum of society. There is no current evidence for or against this modified hypothesis. Rape victims tend to be disproportionately concentrated among young, reproductive-age women. Despite the fact that some women of all ages are raped, the victims of rape are heavily concentrated among young women. In one study of 10,315 rape victims, women between the ages of 16 and 35 were far more likely to be raped than women in any other age category. 85% of all rape victims are less than 36 years old. By way of comparison, victims of other crimes, such as aggravated assault and murder, show a markedly different age distribution. Women between 40 and 49, for example, are just as likely to suffer an aggravated assault as women between 20 and 29. But the older women are far less likely to be raped. Indeed, the age distribution of rape victims corresponds quite closely to the age distribution of women's reproductive value, in marked contrast to the age distribution of victims of other violent crimes. This evidence strongly suggests that rape is not independent of men's broader evolved sexual psychology. That rapists disproportionately victimize young, fertile women, however, is not decisive evidence for or against the competing theories of rape. This finding can be attributed to men's evolved attraction to cues to fertile women in regular mating contexts, rather than a rape-specific adaptation. That is, although there is abundant evidence that men are attracted to young, fertile women across mating contexts, there is no evidence that this attraction is a rape-specific adaptation. One source of evidence that many scientists believe to be relevant to theories of rape is the pregnancy rate that follows from rape. If rape evolved as a reproductive strategy, it must historically have resulted in reproduction some of the time. Modern rape pregnancy rates, of course, are not necessarily relevant to whether rape resulted in pregnancy in the past, Modern routine contraceptives may reduce current rape pregnancy rapes below those that occurred in ancestral times. Thus, it is all the more startling that one study discovered that pregnancy rates resulting from penile vaginal rape among reproductive age women are extraordinarily high, 6.42%.